Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 318 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Cherise Saywell speaks with Doug Johnston about the correspondence course that showed her she had something to say, the striking sense of place in her writing, her love of clean, understated prose, and the benefits of continuing to write short stories alongside her novels.
Cherise Saywell is a novelist and short story writer. She was born and brought up in Australia and came to Scotland on a working holiday in 1996. Edinburgh has been her home ever since. She began to take her writing seriously after the birth of her first child, starting with short stories. She progressed to writing novels. Desert Fish was published by Vintage in 2011, followed by Twitcher in 2013. But she remains preoccupied with the short story. Cherise's short story, Beef Queen, won the V.S. Pritchett Prize. Pieces of Mars Have Fallen to Earth, the Miss Lexia Prize, and Morelia Spilotta, the Royal Academy Pindrop Award. Her stories have appeared in Miss Lexia, the London Magazine and New Writing Scotland, and in several anthologies, including A Short Affair, Waving at the Gardener, the Bristol Short Story Prize Anthology, and the Bath Short Story Award Anthology. Her story, Pieces of Mars Have Fallen to Earth, was selected for the BBC Radio 4 Opening Lines programme. A strong sense of place is central to Cherise's work, whether the setting is rural Australia, inner city Edinburgh, or outer space. As her work has developed and changed, this has remained constant. She is currently writing another novel while continuing to produce short stories.
Hi, Cherise.
Hi, Doug.
Hi. I wanted to start right at the beginning. You grew up in small town Australia in a place called Casino.
Casino,
right?
Yeah.
Was that a house of books? Was there a lot of reading and writing going on in your house?
No, it wasn't a house of books. I grew up on it as a housing commission estate located behind the cemetery with old railway tracks one way and an abattoir kind of in the distance behind, so prime land. And I know my mother never finished school. I don't know if my father did or not. But neither of them were readers, and it wasn't a bookish household, yeah, not at all. But my mum used to take us to the library. So I was one of those children who, when I started school, I didn't read at all. But by the end of the year, I'd indicated that I enjoyed it. So when my mum would go to get the groceries, she would take us to the library, and I'd borrow a couple of books. And that was a thing. And I did start to write little poems, I think, and we had to write stories at school sometimes, and I really, really liked it. So I discovered quite quickly that this was a thing I could do.
And did you keep that going when you went to study university, or was that kind of burbling away in the background?
No, it's all stopped, actually. I think it was kind of the teenage years, and things were quite complicated at home as well. My parents split up when I was a teenager. I think I was really distracted. And then when I went to university, I still read, but I didn't read fiction the way I read it now. I didn't read it voraciously or even constantly. I read everything I had to read for university, and I did well. I did really well at school as well. But writing again, I do remember sitting down once in the backyard where we lived. We called it backyard, not a garden. And trying to write a story. And I had this feeling that I wanted to write something. But it came with a real sense of failure, because I remember trying to imagine a world or a story and just falling flat and feeling like I had nothing to say. What have I got to say anyway? And I tried writing a journal as well, but I just couldn't stand it. When I looked back over what I'd written, I'd tear it all out and throw it away. So, no, it just all petered out by the time I was a teenager and didn't start. I didn't start again until I was I tried again in my 20s.
Okay. What prompted that?
I did a course. After I had my son, I did a course, and it was a correspondence course, and that really opened my eyes. I think because, as much as anything, it was not just trying to encourage creativity, but showing you the discipline, I think, of writing, showing you how to read. We were just given small things to do. Write a poem about an animal. Write a descriptive poem. And even when I wrote the descriptive poem. I remember I was writing it about these trees I could see from a house we were staying in. But it wasn't just descriptive. By the time I got to the end of it, I realised that I was suggesting a feeling that I had and that I felt the trees had and that the winter had. And it was really exciting because I thought, I didn't know I was going to write that when I set out. So the course, as much as anything, was showing us how to kind of trust in the process and showing us that there was a process.
I mean, your early sort of writing successes were short stories. Was the novel not on your radar at the time? Were you just interested in doing stories, or how was it working out?
I was really frightened about thinking about such a big thing as a novel. And so I think when I did begin to write one, there were a few false starts, I think. But when I did begin to write it, I didn't really know where it was going. I just knew that the idea was too big for a short story. And I was still trying to figure out the short story form as well. I didn't always know if an idea was too big. I think I've had a really long apprenticeship as a writer. I know now if something can work. Not always how to make it work, but I have an instinct for if something will work as a short story. But yeah, that novel, I started it actually, I got 20,000 words in, and then I went away and did a course at Muniac Moore, and I threw away that 20,000 words and started again. I came home with like 500 words or something, just a few pages, but that stuck. It was the opening, and it was a real leaping off point. And every time I would get stuck, I would go back and look at that and think, yes, something significant's happened here that has to lead to more things. And I was confident that I'd written that quite well. So, yeah, that's enough. So much of it has been instinctive for me. I don't always know what to do, but I just know that something is working or isn't working.
And that first novel, Desert Fish, was published in 2011.
Mm.
And they always say that your first novel is very autobiographical. Mm. Is yours? I mean, if so, I'm terrified for your life.
Well, I didn't abandon my baby in a hospital. And it's autobiographical in that sense of place. I think. I didn't want to recreate Casino, but I wanted to revisit some of the things about that place that were beautiful and some of the places that were very bleak and unlovely, and the heat and those long summers where there was no rain, and the way that people talk about people in most small places.
You mentioned sense of place there, and that's something that's really incredibly strongly evoked in all your fiction, I think. Desert Fish, because it's, you're right to talk about the heat in the landscape, it's kind of sizzling off the page. Is it something that you slave over in redrafting, or something that kind of oozes between the lines? How does that work for you?
It's a bit of both. Some stuff, I do like a little bit of, I mean, loosely I'd call it free writing, I suppose, but I do redraft and redraft and redraft. And I like to read things back, and I like it. When it's finished, I know it'll be finished because I do want it between the lines. I want the reader to feel that dry heat and the stickiness you get before storms. And it is really oppressive. And I think because I was here in Scotland when I was writing that, I think oddly that really helped, because I just remembered what was important. And because some people love the heat, but I don't. I'm just not very good at it. And I still can remember what it was like. I remember school assemblies. We would stand in this square right in the sun, and none of us wore hats. And I remember the teachers speeding up at the end of the assembly because kids would start to faint from the heat. And it was that hot, you know, up in the high 30s. And you would just think, how can I get away from this? I think sometimes when people are trapped by their circumstances, it can seem as if the place around them, however beautiful or bleak, I like to try and convey a sense in which that becomes a metaphor, that so that it feels as if the place itself is the trap when it's not. I want there to be an interrelationship between the place and the circumstances. But it wasn't yeah, wasn't easy to do.
But I love that. I mean, I definitely get this with your work, but people have said it about my work as well. They say, well, the place is a character in its own right. That's such a nice compliment.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, especially when you've worked so bloody hard to get that effect. In Desert Fish, I'd only been to that desert that I described there, and it wasn't the exact place. I didn't want to name it because I didn't want to have any kind of loyalty to a particular place. Because then people say, oh, it wasn't like that, or it wasn't like that. And that's distracting from the story, because I want the reader to be completely with the character, and I want them to kind of recognise the place, but not know it. So I'd taken a drive from Adelaide across to Port Augusta, and I remember as well getting the bus back from Adelaide to Brisbane, which took like 29 hours or something in the stinking heat. And we stopped at this little roadside cafe, and we went out the back so my boyfriend could have a smoke. We just sat in, I don't know what I'd call it, it wasn't a field, it was just like red soil and rocks. And I just sat down on this rock waiting for him to have his smoke, and I thought, this place really hates us. It doesn't want us here. It just doesn't want us here. And that, I remembered that when I was writing the scenes where she goes into the desert.
The other thing, I mean, there's a few things that are similar between the two books, as well as that sense of place and how it interacts with the characters. I mean, both books have teenage central characters who are troubled and perhaps unreliable in dysfunctional families. Again, was that something that you realised after the fact, or was it something that you specifically wanted to explore? Because, I mean, there's some very problematic stuff amongst parents and children, actually, is probably the main dysfunction going on in these books.
I am really interested in the way that children and young people relate to situations, because their understanding is curiously often more adult than you would think. I think children have an instinctive understanding for things that are wrong, even if they don't know why. And I find that really interesting.
I want to talk a little bit about the prose style, because I loved it, for a start.
Thank you.
But it's beautifully understated and measured. Now, always it's a bugbear of mine when people say something's easy to read, as if it's an insult. Easy to read doesn't necessarily mean easy to write. And I wondered, is it an arduous process for you to get the prose that simple and understated? And do you overwrite first and then cut, or how does the process work for you?
I overwrite and then cut.
Okay.
And I do aim for simplicity now. And it's funny, the first story I published, Beef Queen, is being republished soon as part of an anthology of stories that were published through the V.S. Pritchett prize, and I had a look at it again because I needed to send them another copy, and I did. It's a bit more wordy than what I'm writing now. I think that's somewhere I've arrived at, and it's partly people I've read, like Kazuo Ishiguro is someone who comes to mind. I think, do you know when you read something and you get to the end of it and you think, what just happened? Because the language is quite straightforward. I don't only like prose that's unfussy, but that's something I like to aim for in my own work.
But part of it is as well, I think it's really interesting when you don't hammer the reader over the head with anything, with any information, so that they have to put it together for themselves a little bit. And that, I think that's part of the enjoyment.
You have to let the reader, you have to let the reader work a bit, yeah. I think, otherwise. And probably in Twitcher, I think I would edit that again if I had a chance. I would go back, because I think probably I was a little bit too obvious or overstated in that at times, in a way that I wasn't in Desert Fish. I don't really know why.
And since those two novels, you've kind of returned to short story writing.
Yeah.
I think you said to me before that we've had a kind of, you've fallen back in love with the form, or you're kind of having a renaissance with it. How has that come about? And how has it been going from short stories to novels back to short stories?
It wasn't planned. No, I'm not prolific. It takes me a long time. I'm a slow writer and a slow editor, and I like to get things just right. And I don't always know when they're just right. I'll think something's finished and then I'll look at it again a few weeks later, and I'll find it wasn't finished after all, or I'll see something I hadn't seen before, sometimes something really obvious. But before Desert Fish, so I think I published only a handful of stories. And then when I was writing Desert Fish, and I had really small children then, so my two boys were really little. So it did take a long time, and there wasn't time really to write short stories as well. And then when I wrote Twitcher, I had a 2-book deal, so I had to deliver something else within a couple of years. And then I was working as well for a sports publisher 5 days a week. So that was really hard getting that done. But after that, I was out of a deal and I had an idea for another novel, but it wasn't working. And then things shifted in my life so that, well, things were quite chaotic for a while and we were moving house. And I think my concentration, I think it was quite fragmented and I had to put that novel away. I couldn't make it work. And I started another one and I couldn't make that work either. But I was reading a lot more short stories. I wasn't reading novels that were holding my concentration, but I was reading into stories a lot more. I am in the middle of a novel now that I know I will finish. But I find short stories so satisfying because you can pack so much in to such a small number of words.
Yeah, it's like it's more distilled.
And I like that distillation. And in a way, that's what I was trying to achieve in my prose in those novels. But you do it in a more rounded way in the short story. And there are so many ways you can use the form as well. So I think when I wrote my Mars story, that was really exciting. Pieces of Mars have fallen to Earth. Because I'd carried an idea around in my head for 6 months and I wasn't doing a lot of writing. And then it happened in like 2 weeks. And because it was a bit otherworldly, I think, it was a little bit not experimental. It was just a story about a woman missing her son, but it was set in a world that doesn't exist yet, where people can live on Mars. And I didn't think, when I sat down, I'm going to write a story about a man who goes to Mars, or about a woman who misses her son. It just seemed to come together on the page, and I realised what I was writing as I was writing it. And I really enjoyed stripping that story back as well. And I didn't think I will write a 2,000-word story. I just wrote it till it was finished. And I wrote a little story about a woman observing her husband's grief after that. So I started to build up a little bit of a body of work. And for someone like me, it takes a long time to write a novel. And it can be really disheartening when during those periods when things aren't working. So if you can sit down with an idea and write a short story that's really distilled and finish it, it can give you such a boost. It gives me such a boost when I finish something like that. And if I can place it somewhere, publish it somewhere, I feel like, you know, my writing life is still going on, even though this novel's taking a long time.
I feel like short stories they feel like a palate cleanser, almost. Yes. And especially if you're on a big project, you can feel in the middle of a novel that you're really getting bogged down with the boring stuff in the middle.
Yeah.
And just being able, you're right, being able to do that in a short little burst.
It gives you a real buzz.
Yeah.
It gives me such a buzz. And if I finish something I'm really happy with, it doesn't matter if it's like 1,000 words or 4,000 words. I just think, God, wow, I can do this, you know. And I've got something to say. And I think that's the thing. I remind myself that I've got something to say. I've got a story to tell.
And you seem to be, I think the more recent short stories, you seem to be diversifying and experimenting, perhaps. Not talking about crazy postmodern fiction necessarily, but experimenting in the form and perhaps the kind of language you're using and the themes as well. Some of the early stories reflected the novels and they had certain themes and certain kinds of characterisations. But it strikes me that you're kind of spreading your wings a little bit. Does it feel like that?
Yeah, definitely. Something's happened in the last 5 years. I don't know if it's kind of washing up on the shores of middle age or... It's partly not having a deal, you know, at the moment as well. It gives you a kind of freedom. So what a wonderful form that you can tell, you know, a tiny little story that just happens in a moment, or you can tell something that happens over years and years that's really big, that's huge in scope. It's really kind of Yeah, both muscular and expansive. There's so much that can be contained in it. But I don't find it easy. And that time I wrote, you know, my Mars story in 2 weeks, I probably spent another 2 weeks after that continuing to edit it. But that's really unusual for me.
Having said all that about short stories, you are currently still working on a third novel.
Yeah, yeah.
How is that experience?
It's really hard. The central idea is the same as it was way back at the start, but I haven't been able to isolate why I'm struggling to move it forward. I mean, I've got, I don't know, 50, 55,000 words. I've cut away 40,000 words. It's like two steps forward, one step back. I always think I've isolated what the issue is. And this week I thought, oh, I think I know what the issue is. It's not a technical thing. This is the way, if it were just a technical thing, I could sort it out quite easily. And I like those technical problems because they're always much easier to solve than you think. They're laborious, but they're not difficult to solve. But when it's a problem with what's at the heart of it, it's usually to do with the character, I think. And that's just, I just have to wait it out, try things out, you know, cut it if it doesn't work, try something else out. So I know loads of things that are going to happen in terms of the plot, but there's, in order for it to work, there has to be like an underlying kind of logic, a kind of psychological honesty, I suppose, for the, like verisimilitude, you know, for the reader to believe in the story I'm trying to tell.
Well, good luck.
Thanks.
it's been great talking to you, Cherise. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That was Cherise Sewell in conversation with Doug Johnston. You can find out more about Cherise on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 318, which was recorded by Doug Johnston and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 319, Nick Kaister speaks with Anne Morgan about the challenges of translation and the importance of writing creatively in your own language too. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.